Hello and welcome to Baylor Connections, a conversation series with the people shaping our future. Each week we go in-depth with Baylor leaders, professors, and more, discussing important topics in higher education, research, and student life. I'm Derek Smith, and our guest today is Dr. Sarah Schnitker. Dr. Schnitker is an associate professor of psychology and neuroscience. She came to Baylor in 2018 and brings an expertise in virtue and character development in adolescents and young adults, with a particular focus on the role of spirituality and religion in virtue formation. She recently received a $2.6 million grant from the John Templeton Foundation, along with co-principal investigator Benjamin Holtberg from the University of Southern California, to galvanize widespread development of virtue interventions for adolescents in settings like sports teams, religious organizations, and more. She's been traveling throughout the summer, getting ready for the new semester, which isn't too far off now, and she's with us today here on the program. Sarah Schnitker, welcome to Baylor Connections. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to talk with you this morning.
Well, an interesting topic and an exciting time for you as you and Dr. Holtberg have received this this grant. That's a very sizable grant that's going to give you a lot of opportunities mm-hmm. to work on that, and we're going to delve into that, but let's get to know you a little bit first. You were at Fuller Theological Seminary prior to coming to Baylor last year. So what brought you from there to here?
Well, besides trying to escape the LA traffic,
yes.
which was something we were ready to do, mm-hmm. I was just very attracted to Baylor's Illuminate strategic plan and aspirations to really become a Research One university. My research has been gearing up more and more the last decade, and just thought that Baylor would be a great place to study some of the topics I really care about, especially with the focus of Illuminate on human flourishing mm-hmm. and character development and virtue development. This is something Baylor is really committed to. And so I thought this is a place I can be and a place I can do this important work.
Well, when did your interest in psychology begin? And then further, when did you realize that you could meld psychology, faith, and virtue in your professional role?
You know, my interest in psychology actually began in high school. Mm-hmm. I love math and science. I was often the only girl in my computer science mm-hmm. class or my statistics class, and I just love those methods. But I really like the topics of the humanities and philosophy in particular, and really trying to understand those big questions of what's meaning in life and how do we help people grow. And so psychology seemed to be a really perfect discipline to meld those two together, so we could look at how do we develop character? How do we help people flourish in this world? But using really rigorous methods and being able to falsify our ideas, I think, was something that was very attractive that science provides. And so that's really what drew me to psychology. And my freshman year in college, I worked with Dr. Peter Hill at Grove City College and realized that it was a perfect place for me because we can study the science of virtue and understand how to help people develop character strengths in their lives. So very early in my mm-hmm. life, this became the clear direction of what I wanted to do.
We are visiting with Dr. Sarah Schnitker, Associate Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience. And, you know, when you talk about topics like character, like virtue, certainly from the outside, it seems like those could be things that are difficult potentially to measure. They're not tangible. What are some of the ways you apply that rigorous discipline to those topics?
Yeah, you know, from the outside it looks difficult, and once you get inside it's even more difficult than you
that.
Might imagine. So mm-hmm. you're correct there. You know, there's a lot of challenges in measuring these things. So how grateful is someone? How patient is someone? How much hope or joy does someone have? You know, like in all psychological studies, measurement is a big problem, right? So we can just ask people, how patient are you or how grateful are you? And sometimes we do that. But as you can imagine, especially with these more positive traits, there's a lot of pressure to appear virtuous, right? Mm-hmm. I'm a good person. Yes, I'm grateful. And so what we try to do with virtues is use a multi-method approach to measuring them. And we're really actually working on developing some new measures right now with my postdoctoral research associate, Dr. Jennifer Schubert, and one of my grad students, Juliet Ratchford. So sometimes we can look at what people do or try to contextualize how they answer questions. So with virtue in particular, it's about people cultivating habits that they utilize on a regular basis in their daily life. So just doing it one time is not enough, right? Mm-hmm. You need to be grateful or patient or hopeful on a continual basis. But with virtue, and if you look at philosophers, they say this is really important. It's also internalizing the right reasons for doing those habits and having an identity that says, I care about doing something good in the world, something beyond myself, something moral. And so what we are doing in our approach to measurement is trying to measure what people do on a repeated basis and what they're trying to do, how they're doing it, and then also try to tap into why they're doing things and a bit of their narrative identity is one approach we use. So it's hard, it's difficult, and we just keep trying. Mm-hmm. So that's the best we can do is keep going forward and persevere.
What does that measurement look like? Is it self-reporting?
Yeah, or? So we do different things for different studies, but one thing we're trying right now is a goals-focused measurement. So asking people to list, like, what are the 10 goals you're working on right now in your daily life? And then for that, each goal they list, say, how patient are you in pursuit of this goal? How much courage do you exert? How much fear do you feel? Do you overcome that feel? So trying to see what people are trying to do and how they typically approach those goals. Another approach we do is contextualizing to the tough times in life. So we might, if we're looking at kind of an intervention for our sports team, we might say, okay, in the last week or two, what was the biggest conflict you had on your team during practice? And asking, what did you do? Did you yell during that conflict? Did you get angry? Kind of reporting a variety of responses someone could have that are both virtuous and some not so great ways to respond. And then kind of aggregate different questions and say, okay, it seems that in this specific context, they were this level of patience and this level of grateful and this level of angry and this level of giving up. And so you can do that. And then what's most challenging then is to say, okay, after we give an intervention to this team to try to teach them to be more purposeful or more patient, 6 weeks later, can we try that measure again and say, okay, now in the last week, think about the hardest conflict you've had. How did you respond now? And so we're hoping to look at change. And that's often the most difficult type of measurement is to be sensitive to change.
We are visiting with Dr. Sarah Schnitker. And Dr. Schnitker, when you tell people what you do who are maybe outside of academia or outside of the discipline, what are the common are there common questions you get? Are there themes that you hear regularly?
Yes. You know, oftentimes the first reaction is, like, I didn't know you could study those things with scientific methods. So some surprise. People are pretty intrigued typically when we start talking about it, especially in the more applied work of helping adolescents develop character strengths. I think people see a need for this kind of work and realize as a culture, as individual schools, as families, as teams, we're not always doing a great job and we need more tools and more understanding of how to do these things. So that's often a common response. Another common response, especially when I talk about my work on the virtue of patience, is people will say, oh, I don't have any of that, right? It's the only virtue where they say that, because I think our culture needs to have a shift in how we look at that virtue and say, actually, this is important. This shouldn't be something that you just throw away. So that's one of my main challenges in my research right now is to really show people patience is good for you and it's good for others and we actually should care about it.
We sort of romanticize the culture. People want to plow ahead.
Yes, they want to plow ahead, get things done.
Yeah.
Which in my work, patience does not prohibit goal achievement. It actually facilitates it. But realizing that sometimes pushing hard is not the best strategy and not the best way, especially in some of those more difficult interpersonal relationships or kind of long-term goals, that you need to have a sense of timing and a sense of allowing other things to develop and not pushing things too hard.
Well, speaking of patience, Dr. Schnitker, a little less than a year ago, you were quoted in New York Times, and the article was called How to Be a more patient person. So obviously you've talked about some things here that ways we can approach that just a moment ago, but I'll ask you more specifically, are there any, I don't know, any sort of overarching tips or thoughts that you can give people to take away from this angle?
Yeah, you know, as with all virtues with patients, we want to think about the skills needed to develop and then kind of the narrative identity you want to develop. So in terms of skills for patients, there's a variety of things we can do. So we can talk about learning kind of meditative practices or meditative prayer, learning how to calm your body, to be attuned to your emotions, and know when you're getting upset before it's exploded. Mm-hmm. So that's the first step. We can also then teach people, once they are starting to get frustrated or angry, ways to think about the situation in a new way. And this is called cognitive reappraisal. And so let's say, okay, I have a 3-year-old daughter. This morning she threw a little temper tantrum, mm-hmm. right? I could get disoriented, get dysregulated. It could mess up my whole morning. Or I could take a step back, take a breath, and say, she's only 3. This is developmentally appropriate. This is something, I'm the parent. I don't have to get reactive. This isn't about me. This is just her learning, right? So you can reappraise mm-hmm. and think about things in a new way in order to lessen the emotional impact on yourself and help you be more patient. So we want to build those skills. And I always say we want to train, not try, for mm-hmm. those things that you're not going to be great at it the first time you attempt it. So you keep training on those patience building skills. But then the other key component is to really develop a sense of meaning and purpose in life. With patience in particular, we have to think about, why is it we're suffering for something, right? The Latin root of patience is to suffer, right? And patience is about suffering for the sake of something bigger than yourself, right? So with my example of dealing with the temper tantrum of my 3-year-old, mm-hmm. it's, you know, parenting is a sacred calling. This is something that is one of my most important things in my life, is helping to cultivate another human being and help them develop and mature and become a person of character. Mm-hmm. And so this is worth it, to put up with this suffering for the sake of love, for the sake of helping someone else. And so the more we can cultivate that purpose, that bigger picture of why something is worth pain and suffering and waiting, the easier it will be in the moment to practice those skills of patience.
That's good. This is Baylor Connections. We are visiting with Dr. Sarah Schnitker, Associate Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience here at Baylor. And let's shift gears a little bit. We talked about your research project in character and virtue interventions with adolescents and young adults, $2.6 million grant from the John Templeton Foundation. First off, congratulations on
you.
That. I mean, obviously, when we see numbers, that doesn't tell the story of what it is you're doing. But what does when you're able to get a grant like that, what does it mean to you of just the importance of people see the work that you'll be doing?
You know, I think sometimes this work on character development in young people is, people are like, oh, that's just fluffy or not really scientific, or oh, it's just your intuition on what works. And I think it, when you get this kind of sizable award, it shows that, no, this is rigorous science. This requires a lot of serious money to mm-hmm. be able to do this important work and to do it correctly and well. And so it's really exciting to see the John Templeton Foundation give this kind of money towards this work, because it shows that it's important and that's worth investing as a society, and that we need real research and can't just be guessing on what works with teenagers and what doesn't. We actually need to find out and test our ideas and see if we're wrong and see, oh, that doesn't work. That's not a good idea. Let's mm-hmm. try something else. And so it's really exciting to get that kind of money to do that.
What does it look like as you work to galvanize widespread scientific virtue development for adolescents? What exactly does that mean, and what does that look like in practice?
Yeah, so with our grant, we noticed that, first of all, very few scientifically vetted virtue interventions have been created for adolescents. A lot have been created for adults. And actually scientifically tested with adults. And then people often say, okay, it works with adults. Let's use it for teenagers. But it doesn't work that way. Teenagers' brains are developing, and so their capacities and how they think and what they need is actually a little bit different than adults. And so if we want to develop virtue interventions for teens, we actually need to test them with teens. And the other thing with interventions for teenagers is that paying attention to the context is really important. So we know that teenagers are in various types of contexts. So they're in school, and that there's actually a good amount of work done in school, but very little work's done in out-of-school context. So sports teams, churches, boys and girls clubs, a variety of social services, places where teenagers are spending time, but we're not capitalizing on that time spent in those contexts. So we decided with this grant to really partner with practitioners. So the people who really are on the ground, boots on the ground, working with teenagers, will tell a scientist like, no, my teenager's never going to do that activity. They'll think that's ridiculous. And working with us to create an intervention that will work with a teen, and then testing it out in the context and seeing even different types of contexts. So does it work better in a faith-based context, or does it work better in a secular context, and why, and what's going on? So really doing this with community leaders. The other component of that grant, so we're working with the scholars and practitioners. And so what we did was we ran a funding competition to get some other teams beyond our own working on different contexts and different virtue interventions. But we also, when we were writing the grant, recognized, as many people are recognizing, that teenagers are spending most of their time these days, you might argue, on their phones. Right. Mm-hmm. I think I saw a stat, it's for the high school student, it's about 9 hours a day of media use outside of school and classwork. So that's a ton of time. And
it's
very
not all of it outside.
I know. Right, I'm like, well, they're also not getting enough sleep because of it. Right, but we'll, we won't go there too much. And so we said, we need to go to where they're at, right? There's some efforts to try to get teens off their phones, but that's a difficult task. It may not really be possible. So let's put our interventions in their social context online. So we've also run a competition, and we're in the midst of judging right now, of asking people who develop technological products, who develop media, to create prototypes of products that might build virtues through technology that adolescents use. And so we're going to pair them with scientific consultants and really try to bring the best of what we know from science, but what we also have in terms of design and something a teenager actually wants to use, and try to create products that would help teenagers build virtue. And so that's a little bit more of a risk in terms of grant making. Not a lot of people have really done that, but we are excited to try it out and see what happens.
When you talk about whether it's on their phone or whether it's more in person or in group context, you talk about the fact that obviously adolescents are different than adults. And I know there's probably a ton of different ways we could go with that, with this question. But you know, maybe generally, what are some things when you think about this being effective specifically to adolescents? What are some of the main, you know, what are some of the main things you filter that through?
Yeah, you know, I mean, one of the biggest differences is the frontal lobe. Whereas where a lot of your self-control, executive function, your ability to regulate, frontal lobe is very much still developing in adolescence. And so adolescents in some ways can't regulate themselves the same way adults can. And so those interventions oftentimes need more scaffolding, and they need more adult support than, say, an intervention you could give to an adult. There you could maybe say, here's a workbook or here's something, try it out. Adolescence, it needs to be broken down into smaller steps. So like that cognitive reappraisal, for instance, I was talking about with the virtue of patience. With adults and even college students, so not that much farther than adolescents, you can say, here's an example, this is what you try to do, and then they can go off and do it. With adolescents, one time we tried to give them the same intervention we had used with college students, and it did not work. They need it in small steps. They need more modeling of what that looks like, and maybe even social support to say, this is worth trying. This isn't just a silly thing. And so we've got to give more scaffolding for a teenager because that regulation is more difficult.
We are visiting with Dr. Sarah Schnitker on Baylor Connections. If there is a person of responsibility who works with young adults, a coach or a teacher or a youth pastor, an intervention that's maybe not on the phone but more in that group setting, how could they utilize that?
Well, it's a little difficult right now to tell them because we don't actually have very many yet. So we do plan with all of our teams that are creating interventions. One of the requirements of the grant is to create an implementation plan, right? So we don't know quite yet, but we want to take the intervention we test and we will say, okay, here's the setting or settings we tested it in. And here are the factors you need to attend to if you are in the same setting. And if you're taking an intervention that was developed, say, in a church and trying to test it out in a Boys and Girls Club, here are some things you might need to attend to because these are differences between those settings. And we'll try to tell people what's the most essential psychological features and mechanisms and what can be changed. So unfortunately, I don't have an answer for you quite yet. You'll have to check back
with
me.
It's a multi-year process.
Yep, these are all just getting started. So in about 2 years from now, I actually should be able to tell you.
We'll have to have you back on again to talk about that as it's implemented all the more as we visit with Dr. Sarah Schnitker. Heading into the final few moments here on the program. And Dr. Schnitker, the process for you of trial and error, of coming up with things and thinking about how it could impact students, what do you enjoy most about that sort of investigative and almost R&D process?
You know, I enjoy that it's always challenging. It never gets boring. And I never run out of things to do. It's, I guess that's its greatest curse and joy of the process is there is so much more to do than we have done. And that it's learning and growing. You know, when I'm in the classroom with my students here at Baylor, I tell them, you know, my classroom time is actually the easy time because I already know the answers of what I'm trying to teach you. And I try to bring research into the classroom to tell students, I don't know the answers when we're doing this research and I don't know what will work. And that's scary, but it's also what's fun and exciting and wakes me up in the morning to see what's going to happen today.
Well, we will look forward to seeing more of what you do and hearing more about this intervention program with the Templeton Foundation grant in the months and years ahead. Dr. Sarah Schnitker, thanks so much for joining us on the program today.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Sarah Schnitker, Associate Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience, our guest today on Baylor Connections. I'm Derek Smith. A reminder, you can hear this and other programs online at baylor.edu/connections.